Yankees Files podcast. We are back. I'm Will Harris. You're Alec Whipple. And the rest of you are fans of a team that has actually been pretty good since we last spoke. The New York Yankees took 3 of 4 from the Red Sox in the weirdest series scheduling wise of the year. They, of course, played 2 doubleheaders on non-consecutive days, thanks to 2 rainouts. So that was just an unusual way for things to go. And then they went to Pittsburgh and took 2 out of 3. And you all know that. But you also know that the most important thing is that it's September 18th. And the Irish are undefeated. And prior to us speaking to you next, they will play a top 10 tilt at Notre Dame Stadium against the Buckeyes of Ohio State. And Whipple, I just want to promise right now that if the next time we record a podcast, Notre Dame is 5-0, I'm going to be a special kind of insufferable. With that, how are you doing?
You always lead into me on the Notre Dame topic, and I support you. I just don't have the same excitement for Notre Dame.
Not that you would.
My alma mater was a D3 school that doesn't really have the football energy and atmosphere. And my current law school is a bottom of the road D1 school that doesn't really have a sports environment. So my energies go into rooting for those Yankees of New York. And
But you fear the Indians of Cleveland and the Tigers of Detroit.
I'm glad you got that. At this point in the season, I think taking away from the outside chance the Yankees have to make the playoffs, you just want to end the year with, leaving a good taste in your mouth, seeing development from multiple angles. As we talked about last week, most of the things that we're each looking forward to outside of the Gerrit Cole Cy Young chase are really longer-term developmental aspects of the team. And I think definitely not like 100%, everybody's crushing it. This team's going to be all cylinders firing going into the offseason. There's some things that I think we've been disappointed by, but I think a lot of very positive things, positive player development stories, both from the prospects that were called up and from the guys on the team who might be in new roles or might be looking to just end the season on a high note going into 2024. And I think when you go 5-2 in a week, when you really should have gone, maybe 6-1 if the balls bounced a different way or the BABIP gods didn't hate you, I don't think you can be upset. I think the time to be upset has kind of passed, and now we're just we're going to see how this ends. We're going to ride it out. And I feel pretty good about at least watching baseball from that angle. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, the Yankees do have at least a better chance than they would if the schedule shaped out a little bit differently. I don't think it's a possibility. Like, it's not a distinct possibility, but it's a very remote possibility that, maybe in another week we're having a different conversation. The fact that they have played this well to get to the point where it's even a possibility after where they were a few weeks ago, I think at least leaves you feeling good about how the first part of September has gone.
Yeah, I don't think I'm ready to...
No.
Yeah, okay, I know.
But we're just saying it's...
I agree. It's surprising.
It's out there.
It's out there, and it's surprising that the Yankees made it a discussion point, given that not that long ago they were 62-68.
Right. There's not an E next to their name at this point in the season, and a few weeks ago it looked like that would be 100% probability at this point.
Absolutely. So, Whipple, I think in the last few weeks, and rightfully so, we've kind of gotten away from talking about the particulars of the game because there aren't really many good particulars to discuss, especially with Pereira nursing an injury that's kept him out, with Dominguez hurt and out for, a significant portion of next season as well. But there are a few players I want to highlight, and one guy who has had just an absolutely baffling season is Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. And I want to put this in perspective for you. So, top line stats, IKF in 344 plate appearances has been worth 0.2 Fangraphs WAR. For reference, last year in 531 plate appearances, he was worth 1.5 Fangraphs WAR. You know, a lot of that is him playing the outfield a good amount, and he grades out as, you know, not all that good an outfielder. If we look at his fielding metrics, what you find is outs above average, basically neutral in right field, a little bit better than neutral in center. In all, as an outfielder, he's basically neutral, and by outs above average and marginally negative, he's at -4 by DRS. So they haven't done him any favors with respect to WAR with where they're playing him. He's done it competently. It's whatever. But he's gotten to this number, this 0.2 WAR and this 82 WRC plus, actually down from 86 last year in such a weird way. So I just want to take you back along this journey, because I feel like this narrative got set by about the All-Star break, and then people have just run with it. So IKF started off the season in his first 83 plate appearances. He had a 23 WRC plus. He was awful. He was slashing 182, 232, 208. Now, he had a 212 BABIP. That wasn't going to keep happening. He was doing the kinds of stuff that people like him to do. For example, not striking out very often. But it was classic IKF. There was no slug in the game, a ton of ground balls, hitting the ball softly, etc. And then from May 16th to July 1st, the IKF narrative happened. He got 104 plate appearances. He hit 323, 365, 531 with five home runs for a 147 WRC plus. And it was like, oh my gosh, this version of IKF is amazing. Even if his 356 BABIP comes down, like, this is a guy who could be productive. Look, he's playing all over the field. Maybe he's played his way into a roster spot for next year. People were saying, you know what, just extend him now. That was weird. And I think people just kind of sat on that narrative. But what I think has gone kind of unnoticed, or maybe just has been overshadowed by everything else that's gone on with this team since July, is since July 2nd, IKF is hitting 213, 306, 279 for a 69 WRC plus. His strikeouts are up over either of the two prior periods I mentioned. He has one home run and only six doubles in that time and 157 plate appearances. Like, he's been a special kind of bad for 2.5 months now. And I was reflecting on this earlier because, as I said, he started off the season terribly and then kind of played his way into everyone's hearts. This is the same IKF it's always been. It's been, he's produced exactly what you'd expect from him in a weird way, but this is the same guy. And I'm wondering, is this something you were up to speed on? How have you been thinking about him? Like, where do you stand on the IKF issue? Because sure, the Yankees didn't put him in the best of situations, but he's been a terrible hitter, which we knew he was. His base running got significantly worse. He had the second worst base running season of his career. Like, what do you make of this guy? I think he's one of the most unusual, enigmatic players the Yankees have ever had. He's so hard to understand. And then the reaction to him is even weirder.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I feel like he just kind of like faded into the woodwork this season, where all the stuff you were saying, like the stuff he did well last year, which was like, I mean, well, I guess aside from the defensive debate I remember we had, where he either graded out really poorly or really pretty good. Like last year, I mean, he, like you say, he was a good base runner. He didn't strike out that much. He was fast. Like, that stuff kind of came back to earth, and the other stuff like ticked up slightly. And I feel like it's weird because he just seems like, from looking at it, like the same kind of season. I just feel like I don't really have an opinion where his numbers have tanked off so much and this stuff has really leveled out or come back to earth. And I don't know. I think he just has become one of those guys where he was in the lineup a lot of the days in August, and I think there was so many other issues people kind of forgot about him, and now he's not playing at all. And I mentioned, a little more than he was a few weeks ago, but he's heading into his walk year with basically sitting out the last month and a half. And objectively, that's probably the right result. I think we're going to look back on him, and I just guess, or I'm betting he's going to be one of those people that, even despite everything you said, people are going to have a fond memory of him because that narrative has been written, and it's been written for this year, but I think it's shadowing all of the bad things he did this year, but it really is overshadowing how much a part of the problem he was last year. And I think it's going to be weird. Like, couldn't you see him, like, I hate to say it, but like an old timer's day in like 10 years?
Oh, guaranteed. Yeah. Like, there's no chance he's not at one of those.
Right. So he's going to be the player who everyone does not remember all of the negative moments. And at the end of the day, his problems are the same. I mean, he ticked up the slug this year, but at the end of the day, he doesn't slug enough to be consistently good at anything.
Yeah, and his ISO is exactly 100. Like, right, it's not good.
For a contact hitter to be hitting as an average as a Yankee, you know, in the 240s, 250s over those 2 years is just not, it's not going to cut it in any circumstance. At least it's not as the starting shortstop, but, you know, that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, weird year. Just weird year to be Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. And then, so for IKF, it was kind of a tale of three seasons. For DJ LeMahieu, it's been very much a tale of two seasons. We can't ignore this. I know that people are annoyed with DJ LeMahieu's inconsistent production after the 2020 season. I know that he hasn't been exactly the guy that people expected him to be, but DJ LeMahieu in his last 212 plate appearances, putting up a 135 WRC plus, that's since the All-Star break, walking 13% of the time, striking out under 20% of the time, with a BABIP that's not crazy, slashing 279, 377, 459. I don't think DJ LeMahieu over a full season for the rest of his career ever will be a 135 WRC plus hitter. But the notion that he doesn't have 110 or 115 left in him with his workload managed properly, which the Yankees ought to be able to do, I can't get down with that anymore. I mean, he's at 101 despite an abysmal start to the season and a lower BABIP than he's typically posted throughout his career for a guy who sprays the ball to all fields. Like, I don't like to speculate about how different profiles are going to age or whatever, and DJ being the slowest human on the planet is not going to help him as he gets into the second half of his 30s and is still trying to hit at the major league level. But, like, this guy can be productive. I don't have any doubt about that. And I think that's something else that has gotten lost in the second half of this year amidst all the narratives of how bad the team has been and the need to call up the kids and anything else you want to talk about. DJ LeMahieu's been seriously good for a sample of a couple hundred plate appearances. And obviously it doesn't erase how bad he was. But as we think about positive indicators going into next year, DJ could have cratered in the second half. And that would have told us this guy is cooked and the Yankees have to figure out what to do with him for the next 3 years. I would argue that the second half of this season has shown us that there is still a productive player of some type in there, and the Yankees just have to deploy him correctly to be able to harness it.
Yeah, I think the most encouraging thing for me is his on-base percentage is 380, 377. So that's, I mean, when you're in the first half, when he had an on-base percentage that was in the 200s, you know, that that's huge. I mean, that's the DJ LeMahieu that we had said a few months ago. The doesn't have to be 2019, 2020, but first half of 2022, when he was OPSing 800 with about a low 400 slugging and a low 400s on base percentage. I mean, that's a player that helps the Yankees, you know, in any situation. And I mean, I hate to bring it up, but, you know, you know who he's crediting for this. I'm curious about how your reaction to that news is. And before I know what you're going to say, I want to get on the record and say that I don't think a hitting coach, much like a manager, can take away from his team as much as he can add to it in small parts, where I don't think Dylan Lawson or Sean Casey are to blame for anything that's gone on at a large macro level, because this offense, these hitters need to be responsible. But much in the way I think a good manager has some positive value on the margins, I think Sean Casey should at least get credit for DJ LeMahieu's turnaround, if DJ LeMahieu's giving him credit. And I know the response is how bad they've hit and how much they've struck out in the second half. And I just feel like, I don't know. Like, I'm curious to see your reaction. I don't feel like I want to blame the hitters, and I want to at least give Sean Casey the credit he might deserve for helping an individual hitter. I don't know if, like, the proper response is, well, look at all the other hitters that haven't done well. In a logical, you know, debate about this, are you still ripping on Sean Casey, or do you have any other take now that you might be more of a vibes podcaster?
I'm not more of a vibes podcaster. Look, it would be, like, I think there would be something to the DJ LeMahieu, Sean Casey situation if we hadn't seen DJ LeMahieu be exactly this guy in the Dylan Lawson era. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, this DJ LeMahieu was in there, and this DJ LeMahieu produced under Dylan Lawson. So I don't know what I'm supposed to make of DJ LeMahieu crediting Sean Casey with him getting back to getting right or whatever. But I think the response is, look how badly they've hit. Like, Aaron Judge is hitting .214 in the Sean Casey era. .214 in 202 plate appearances. That doesn't happen to Aaron Judge. I mean,
so that wouldn't happen with Dylan Lawson?
I don't think it ever did happen with Dylan Lawson. Like, I think if we're going to say that DJ LeMahieu's production is a result of the presence of Sean Casey, we have to say that everyone's production is a result of the presence of Sean Casey. So, like, Anthony Volpe was on a phenomenal run. He's an 88 WRC plus hitter under Sean Casey. Like, Oswald Peraza is a 62 WRC plus hitter under Sean Casey. Jake Bowers has been completely destroyed under Sean Casey, in spite of the fact that he stings the ball and he now strikes out more than ever. Like, Austin Wells can't hit at the major league level. Everson Pereira can't hit at the major league level. You know, IKF has taken this massive step back since the beginning of July. Giancarlo Stanton is an under 200 hitter in that period of time. He appears to have ruined Billy McKinney. Like, what, how am I really supposed to engage with DJ LeMahieu saying, yeah, I give Sean Casey the credit? Like, what am I really supposed to make of that when the team has hit for a 92 WRC plus in the second half? Like, what am I supposed to make of it?
I think from my unbiased perspective, I think that Dylan Lawson's communication was an issue that was somehow casting a negative pall on this team. And I don't think removing Dylan Lawson in favor of Sean Casey had much, if any, material impact. But if one guy is crediting someone else for helping him find something, which I get that DJ LeMahieu did well under Dylan Lawson, but good hitters can go in slumps. And I think the message can be communicated certain ways that aren't the most that they're not the most receptive to. Which is why I want to say I don't think Sean Casey or Dylan Lawson is to blame, but I think at least I would like to credit one hitting coach with helping one hitter. I don't think you can say that Sean Casey ruined the other hitters.
But why do you get credit and do not have to take blame?
Because the guy's giving him credit. DJ LeMahieu's giving him credit.
But would you expect Giancarlo Stanton to come out and say, yeah, the reason I've hit 185 with a 281 on base in the second half is because Sean Casey sucks? Like, if someone has to confirm it, then that standard is ridiculous, and coaches will only ever get credit from their players.
But don't you think at some point then, if people really felt that Sean Casey was detracting from this team, that they would come out either next year or this offseason, and if he gets fired, say, like, yeah, it wasn't working for us, but the next guy's helping us? I mean, I don't know. It's such an arbitrary game to play, but at the very least, like, I think they're Dylan Lawson's firing was such an unprecedented thing that we can at least see there were some issues with him, that maybe Sean Casey hasn't cured those issues, but he's at least helped in some small quantity.
That's a tough one for me to buy into.
I can't buy into the argument that Sean Casey has made this team worse. I can buy into the argument that neither, because I don't think that they were doing especially well under Dylan Lawson either this year.
They weren't doing especially well under Dylan Lawson, but they're doing worse under Sean Casey. So,
but that just might be the ebbs and flows of the season. I mean,
but why couldn't it have been the ebbs and flows of the season for many of them not to hit under Dylan Lawson? And obviously the thing we're ignoring is the Dylan Lawson era stats for 2023 are skewed negatively by the fact that he was getting the lack of Aaron Judge penalty. Like, both of the times, the first time that Judge went down, it was entirely within the Dylan Lawson era. And then the second time that Judge went down, it was like 90% within the Dylan Lawson era. And now the team is hitting even worse, despite having Aaron Judge and resurgent DJ LeMahieu. And I'm supposed to be happy with what Sean Casey has done. Like, if we're going to say that we're giving Sean Casey credit for resurrecting DJ LeMahieu, or however you want to describe it, but the team has hit terribly under Sean Casey, why would I be happy with Sean Casey? Like, it's not making sense in my brain that I'm supposed to credit this guy for this. Like, or should he just be DJ LeMahieu's personal hitting coach? Like, is everything except what he's done with DJ LeMahieu a failure? Like, I cannot understand why he deserves credit for DJ LeMahieu, but no blame for the fact that there are only, you know, if we make the playing time minimum 50 plate appearances, there are only four guys of 15 on the Yankees who have a WRC plus of over 100 in the second half. And there are just as many, in fact, more, who have a WRC plus under 50 in that time.
So, like, but I would like to know why, in your mind, would you give him credit for DJ LeMahieu and blame for everything else, or would you assign no credit or blame to him at all?
I would assign no credit or blame to him at all.
It seems like from your Twitter statements, you don't feel that way, because you continuously take every opportunity to trash him, and you've been vocally upset about him.
I'm sensing some narrative
pushing here.
No, that's not, you're just misinterpreting the tweets. So what happens is Mike, formerly of River Ave Blues, will tweet, the Yankees have struck out like 10 million times in their last four games, and they have, you know, 5,010 strikeout games since Sean Casey took over, and they strike out more than anyone else in baseball in that time period or whatever. And then I quote tweet it and I say, but at least Sean Casey hit 302 in the majors, or at least Sean Casey was a career 302 hitter. I'm not ridiculing Sean Casey. I've made my position clear that what was the tweet that I tweeted right when they fired Dylan Lawson? I said, I can't wait to see how people react when they find out it wasn't insufficient coaching. That's what I said. And then so many people said, no, you know what? This guy knows what it takes to hit in the big leagues. He's a career 300 hitter, you know, all that stuff. Those are the people I'm ridiculing. The people who insist that because Sean Casey hit 302 for his career, he knows something special about hitting that he's going to impart on everyone and have some magical effect. And that's why they'll hit so much better under him than they did under Dylan Lawson, because Dylan Lawson didn't know how to do it in the big leagues. Those are the people that I'm making fun of. I don't think Sean Casey has an incredible impact either way. If he did, he would tell people to bunt before they strike out. Like, that's clearly how he thinks about the game of baseball. I'm not ridiculing the job Sean Casey is doing. I will argue that he should be blamed if someone else wants to argue that he should be given credit, But I'm not giving him credit or blame. I'm making fun of the people who insisted that things would be better under Sean Casey because his having been a major league player gave him some special knowledge. Like, if that were the case, wouldn't Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds have been the best hitting coaches of all time? They were both hitting coaches. If that were the case, shouldn't someone be paying Randy Johnson $50 million to be a pitching coach? Of course not. Because it's not the case. So those are the people I'm ridiculing. I'm not ridiculing Sean Casey.
No, that makes sense. I mean, my position, which I made clear at the time and I still stand by today, is that I don't think there's a material impact in terms of the way people think that, like you said. I mean, I agree with you. Like, a 302 hitter is not going to make everyone hit 302, whatever that means. But in my view of the situation, I think I thought at the time that the issues were with Dylan Lawson's communication, and I thought it was a move that would have little to no downside because I don't think there's a negative impact that can happen, and maybe the communication would help someone unlock something. So I don't think I do think, and maybe this is just where we disagree, I think you can give him credit without giving him blame, because you know what? Maybe the message clicked for DJ LeMahieu. I don't think it negatively detracted from someone else. Maybe
how can you know that though? Like, just because if his style of delivering a message is working for DJ LeMahieu, and his style of then, and that shows us that he can communicate to a hitter, to some hitters, certain hitters, in such a way that he unlocks something with their performance and he helps them get over some hump. If it's also the case that he's communicating that way with 14 other guys and 9 or 11 or however many of those 14 other guys are awful, then isn't that a failing on his part?
Oh, I this is not me arguing that they should keep him for next year, but if Sean Casey gets fired or doesn't come back and the decision was keep Dylan Lawson or keep Sean Casey for the rest of the year, and the only difference is DJ LeMahieu gets fixed, but the offense isn't as good. I don't know. I mean, I just don't think someone can make hitters worse. I think people can at least help make them better. Because I just don't think that's like he's going to have that kind of widespread impact.
Why can he make them so much better?
Because it's a specific situation that we heard about with him working with a specific hitter, and that hitter's clearly gotten better. I mean, maybe he's helped Gleyber Torres go on a second half run. How do we know that hasn't happened?
Because we've seen Gleyber do stuff like this generally before.
We've seen DJ do stuff like this generally before.
Yeah, which I said. Like I'm the one saying I don't think.
Yeah, I think it's not something that you can quantify. I'm just saying, at least like if this was the one positive result and nothing else really happened, I don't know. Like I'm not gonna sit here and be upset that it happened.
But to buy into that, you have to believe that.
I don't think you do.
No, to buy into that, you have to believe that everyone else is going to stop sucking and that he is having no impact on them being terrible.
That's
what you have to believe. You absolutely do. Because if Sean Casey is imparting some wisdom on DJ LeMahieu that's making him good, and everyone who's bad, it's actually an aberration. And I do think, like, I do think it's the case that for many of these guys, it's an aberration. But like, I just can't square in my head. Why would it be the case that Sean Casey makes DJ LeMahieu good, but that's the only person that we associate his performance with Sean Casey's coaching? Like,
I mean, it's kind of similar.
It doesn't make any sense to me. And in fact, it would be way better if DJ LeMahieu still sucked and everyone else was at their career numbers. Like, I want to make that very clear. So if Sean Casey is having an impact, it's been an extreme net negative.
I mean, maybe it's the case that I just don't feel like there's net negative. I feel like it's like the message isn't getting through to a lot of people, but maybe it got through to DJ LeMahieu. I mean, we've seen hitting coaches help specific players with their swings before, like the Kevin Long, Curtis Granderson example. I mean, I just think like it's an isolated situation that at least like it's one positive of the work he did.
So he could not possibly give bad advice. He could not give someone a tip that he encourages them to put in action in the game and have it not work.
To the
like, that's what you're asking me to buy into.
To the point where, well, I mean, I feel like these guys, I mean, they have a veteran team, and I feel like these guys wouldn't necessarily let him screw up their swings like that. And even for, like, the Volpe case, I think it's cherry-picking numbers. I mean, for Volpe case, he had a hot streak in the second half. So he was on a bit of a downslide when the Dylan Lawson era ended. He continued that downslide, and then he picked up about 2 weeks into the Sean Casey era, and then he got better, and then he got worse again. So I don't think there's, like, an exact impact that you can make clear is going to be the impact of a hitting coach, but I just...
There you go.
Exactly. I just find that there are there's specific situations that can be added value that we hear about. Like, I just don't think hitting coaches can screw up teams, but I think they can add in specific places.
That makes one of us.
I mean, the alternative is that he's made this team worse. I mean, maybe he's had no impact, but we're talking about a hitter who clearly assigns him some impact. So how do we square that away? Are we just saying DJ LeMahieu doesn't know what he's talking about and Sean Casey didn't actually
help
him? I
think it's entirely possible that DJ LeMahieu can't tell the difference between his BABIP being 54 points higher in the second half and Sean Casey having figured out something major in the way that he hits baseballs. I think that's very possible that DJ LeMahieu can't separate those things. In fact, I think it's very possible that you can't separate them in the case of Gleyber Torres. Like, unless Sean Casey is a BABIP magician, then, like, a lot of what explains the differences in performance in the between the first and second halves for DJ LeMahieu and Gleyber Torres is just they're both hitting 50 points higher on balls in play than they were before.
I mean, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue that Sean Casey, like, I think it's hard to give a guy credit and not blame, but you're more than welcome to go out and continue to try it. We got to talk about Oswaldo Cabrera. Oswaldo Cabrera is such a weird case this year. As we've established, there are many such cases on the 2023 New York Yankees. So, first of all, he hit left-handed against a left-handed pitcher on Sunday, which led me to ask if he has abandoned switch hitting. It sounds like it's something he's experimenting with, but he has not officially abandoned switch hitting. That is a weird thing. So what made Oswaldo Cabrera good last year as a hitter, Whipple?
His slug and the fact that he pulled balls.
He pulled fly balls, exactly. So there was slug in the production. So going into Sunday's game, Oswaldo Cabrera had a 115 WRC plus since the All-Star break. And the best part of that, by far, was his 383 on-base percentage and 16% walk rate. We've never seen him display that kind of discipline. He came up and began the year as an extremely, extremely free swinger. Now, the problem with his production since the All-Star break is that it's been anchored by a super high BABIP. It was 362 going into Sunday, and his slug in that time was only 353. I was encouraged to look at this because he hit a ball over the fence in Pittsburgh, which is not something he does all that much. So I looked into the difference between this year and last year. Again, going into Sunday's game, he pulled more fly balls in 171 plate appearances in 2022 than he has this year in 279 plate appearances. So, and you can look at his ground ball to fly ball rate. It has skyrocketed this year. And I guess it's encouraging to know that the guy is still there, like that it's still possible for him to pull the ball in the air. But and Ryan Garcia had a good tweet about kind of the Cabrera conundrum, basically pointing out that he sold out for contact, started hitting the ball on the ground, and instead of and did those things instead of pursuing bat speed, and then it made him terrible. Like this, being that style of hitter was never the thing that got him to the major leagues or anything. And yet there he is pursuing it. So it was just really weird. And I think it's hard to, as you project out the roster for next year, and this is something we'll do a lot more in the coming weeks, I don't know what you do with him, because DJ presumably is there, Glaber presumably is there, Peraza presumably is there, Volpe obviously is there. You know, if maybe the Dominguez injury creates a space in the outfield, maybe, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with Everson Pereira, but like, it's hard to find plate appearances for him, and this year has been so weird. The Oswaldo Cabrera saga is just another one that, like, it's hard to know what to make of it or what the future holds for him, but I'm glad, and I will be even more glad if he continues to show that he can find ways to be productive offensively without being a BABIP merchant.
Yeah, I think he's somebody who really needs to get as much run as possible in the next 2 weeks, just so we can see what, you know, kind of he is, as we are learning more and more about him, at least even in the past 2 weeks, where we've made these observations about how he is walking more. You know, he doesn't have much power. The keys to him getting back to where he needs to be are what you said. But I think the hitter that he was last September is the goal for him. I mean, that might be the ceiling. Like, we could have seen the best version of him.
Yeah, it probably is.
And I think he can be something less than that and still be a valuable part of the 2024 Yankees. What he can't be is what he was or has been for a large part of this year. And I think it's interesting because, like you said, it was really the power that kind of elevated him and put him in that position to be the starting left fielder in the postseason. But the versatility is going to, I think, you know, make up. If he can keep the versatility, probably make up for a little bit of regression from that ceiling. I mean, that's what the Yankees dream about, trying to develop with IKF, trying to develop with DJ LeMahieu. I mean, it's really what any team dreams about. The Ben Zobrist model, I feel like, has been chased after for 15 years since Ben Zobrist was such an important part of those Rays teams. And I think he can do it. I just think that the more young guys come up and the more we get into his career, the less willing I think the Yankees will be to sit through the slumps. I mean, we even saw it this year. Like, they were not going to let him keep playing in the way that they were going to let Volpe keep playing through his slumps, just because he's a different caliber of player, different caliber of prospect. It's really interesting as we talk about how we think the next year's roster is going to shape up. Like, I feel like in like 1,000 simulations of the roster, I'd put him on 50 and leave him off 50. Like, he's just
50 plus 50 is 100.
500 and 500. I'm in law school. I can't do math.
That's
I'd
totally
put him
fair.
On 50, I'd leave him off 50, and then I don't know about the other 900. But yeah, I think he can be a real difference maker, or, you know, he just might be kind of like lost in the prospect shuffle. I really don't know. It'll be interesting, and I'm, you know, all this information is known to him. I'm sure that will be what he needs. He knows he needs to do this winter, but it goes to the you know, how I think the, like what Ryan was saying, how the minor league approach is so successful for the Yankees, and trying to, I mean, not to bring up the hitting coach again, but I think it, independent of our disagreements on the impact of hitting coach or Sean Casey, I think we're both in agreement that the Yankees need to do this winter some kind of overhaul or alignment to bring their minor league philosophies and what's worked for well for them into the major league team to really embrace the numbers. I mean, that's Ryan's big point, and I think we both agree with it. There's no reason that this team should be as far behind on hitting and have pitching success stories every other day. I mean, they have too many resources and too smart of people there to not get the hitting, to not basically have a hitting lab. So I hope Oswaldo is one of the first beneficiaries of whatever future hitting apparatus they bring in.
That would be great, because he's a joy to root for. He's fun to watch. He clearly has a great time playing the game. It would be nice to have him around and productive. Last guy I want to highlight is not Estevan Florial. that guy gets talked about too much for being exactly the guy everyone knew he was.
Are you against Esteban Florial now? Not that I think you shouldn't be, but I just feel like you've been so pro Florial. It's like kind of hard to hear.
Yeah, so I'll give it a few seconds. So for a while, I was pro Florial because he was not about to turn 26 and I could not hold as much of his lack of development in the minor leagues against him as I feel I can now. But when he was striking out 30% of the time in AAA and running a 362 BABIP and people were saying he's played too well not to get a chance, like that's not the case when that's exactly the guy he was the year before and it's the guy he was the year before that too, but with some more slug because they juice the balls. Like when I was a zealous advocate for Florial, I thought that there was still development for him to achieve. I was like, okay, that little cup of coffee in 2021 indicates that he can really do something, but the fact that he's the same guy in AAA that he was in 2022 this year, and he's about to be 26 years old, like, it's just hard for me to get bought in on Florial now. So, yeah, I think Florial's a prospect miss for me. I think the Yankees were probably right not to be aggressive with him and are probably right that he doesn't have, like, a super impressive future in the major leagues. Yeah.
It's a sad day because I just remember all the times you've been pushing for him to be called up. And yep. I was taken aback by your tweets. I was like, have you turned to the dark side? But no, everything you said, I agree with too.
Yeah. I think I just missed, like, his development stalled where I guess the Yankees knew it would. And that's the guy he is. But a guy we got to talk about, because he's been just doing weird stuff, is Oswald Peraza. So Oswald Peraza has a 60 WRC plus since he was called up to play regularly in that Nats series, but he has a 136 WRC plus since September 2nd. What is anchoring that? Of course, a 400 BABIP. He has, I think, two walks and 53 plate appearances in that span, which is also weird because the Peraza thing used to be that he would come up to the major leagues and be super patient. That's not been the case. He has not been hitting the ball hard during this time that he's had a high BABIP. His average exit velo in that span has been just over 85 miles an hour. It actually goes up by a mile an hour if you bring in some of the games where he was bad, because he hit a couple balls close to 110 miles an hour in those games. It's just been weird. I think the most exciting thing he did was have a multi extra base hit game in Boston. In, I guess that would have been the second doubleheader where he put one over the monster. That was cool. But, and I've been kind of skeptical of Oswald Peraza's major league bat all year. And I think people were like way too high on it for a while, but I have no idea what to think of this guy, because like, if he can hit the ball over the fence and get extra base hits, that's like a very good thing for him to be doing. If he hits the ball really softly and relies on BABIP and can't really slug, then they don't need him around. Like, I don't know what the future holds for Oswald Peraza, certainly, and I believe he's going to be out of options next year. Yeah, he will. So the Yankees have like a big decision to make. Again, we can speculate about what that decision will be on a later episode, but just again, along with IKF, along with DJ LeMahieu, along with Oswaldo Cabrera, just another guy who's had a super weird year, even if you just consider the times when he's been up for an extended run.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, like, I feel like I kind of agree where even without looking at the numbers, he's been hitting well, but it doesn't seem like he's been hitting well. It seems like he just has been a very blatant case of BABIP luck, I feel like. And
yeah,
usually, like, I'm probably a little more forgiving of that than you, but in his case, I don't know. I just don't feel it in the same way that, like, I feel like I would if there was some juice behind his stats. What's his future? I just don't think you can hand him a starting position next year, but at the same time, I mean, if he's going to show anything with the bat, his defense has been so good that he should at least be in contention. Like, we've said he should be the part of a trade for at least, like, 2 years now, and I just don't think teams are viewing him as the headliner of a trade, even though Yankees fans want to and probably will keep wanting to. And we can't really fix that public perception or the way other teams will perceive him. Like, that's definitely a gap in valuation, and I think the Yankees have been kind of stuck with that as well. Like, I get the sense that they don't know what to do with him. They don't know where to put him in trades, and that's reflected the fact that he hasn't really gotten consistent run until the last month. So I don't know. They're going to have a crowded infield again, but do you really feel comfortable giving him a starting spot? Less comfortable than I did for Volpe. I mean, he had every chance to win it last year, but I just still just feel more comfortable with the way Volpe's played, even though Volpe hasn't lived up to all of the expectations, than Peraza. It's been a very weird year. And I think of the weird years we've talked about, like, it's been the weirdest. And every time I think about him, like, I genuinely don't, like, I guess the last thing I'll say is, like, I feel like at this point in the season, I kind of know, like, what people's stat lines are in my head. And I just, like, did not, like, I can't visualize what his stat line is. I can't put it to his face just because, like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like he's earned it in any way. It doesn't feel like he's been that bad. It doesn't feel like he's been that good recently. The Yankees are going to have an infield logjam again, and the solution better not be trading Gleyber Torres, because I think everybody should be on the same page of that just can't happen.
It better not.
Preview of coming attractions. I'm definitely in my offseason plan. I'm not on that page, partly because I don't think you're going to get value for a player 1 year away from free agency. And partly because even if they don't want to extend him, I don't think they're going to lose anything. Extensions a year before free agency are about the same cost largely as actual free agent contracts. So I think if they don't want to extend him, that's fine. But there's no way that the solution should be plug in Peraza and subtract the one of two above average hitters in this lineup.
Yeah, man. I have nothing to add there. I think you covered it.
A lot of interesting questions this winter.
We will have a lot to discuss, and unfortunately, we will probably be discussing it earlier than we'd like to, as that is how this season has gone. Well, Whipple, I think it's time for us to wrap this one up. As always, we do that with confidence. Confidence has meant weird stuff in the last few weeks since we kind of pronounced this season, or at least the World Series hopes, dead. So tell me how you're thinking about confidence, and if you, what did your dad say? Assign a numerical value or something like this, place on the numerical spectrum.
The numerical spectrum.
Yeah, whatever it was.
He thinks he's hilarious, by the way.
I think he's hilarious too. If maybe not as funny as he thinks he is, but I think he's funny. So if you can give it a value.
Well, I'm probably a little more confident than Doug Whipple, who is spending his Yankees watching time sending me pictures of the post cover with A-Rod superimposed on a rat's body. That, like, I don't know. Maybe that should be, like, my confidence image for today.
That's awesome.
No, and I think in terms of numbers, like, it's just going to be, you know, 6-7. What was it, 5.5 last week? I'll say 6. Because I don't think it can go that high with just the way the season is. But for what the Yankees have been doing, they've been doing it pretty well. And I think that's kind of all you want to see. I mean, Gerrit Cole's still on pace for a Cy Young. We've seen flashes from Austin Wells. We've seen Oswald Peraza, even though it might be BABIP fueled, at least show signs of being successful at the major league level. Someone we didn't talk about who I'm excited by and can't wait to at least think about more this winter, Mike King, starter edition.
Sure.
Pretty good. Rodon is not a negative value on this team. He looks like he's actually finding something. So, you know, the DJ LeMahieu stuff that we talked about, it's the little things that, you know, the Jason Dominguez injury is still and will be a huge bummer. But I think the guys who are on the field, at least, you know, more than half of them are showing that there are reasons to be optimistic for next year. And you know what? They're winning games. And at the end of the day, even if it's too little too late, I like to see the Yankees win baseball games. And you know what? On a personal level, I'm enjoying seeing them win games, because in 2 weeks, we're not going to have that till March, April. And that's a long time. So, you know, that's kind of fun, I guess. I don't know. I'm running out of things to say about this team.
Yeah, there's not a lot left to add. You know, as we've discussed, the story's kind of been written. I think I agree with you. I'm the Pereira nursing something and that keeping him out of the lineup, and that meaning he's not able to just go out and get some results to build on, that's really disappointing to me. Obviously, the Dominguez injury is really disappointing. So my big, like, finish strong narrative for those guys kind of goes by the wayside. As far as confidence in this team, I think you're right. A lot of stuff has moved in the right direction. Clearly, the Rodon situation has moved in the right direction. I think Austin Wells showing that he can hit at all at the major league level, that's something that's worth being excited about. And again, that's like a couple at bats that we're talking about, to be clear. The Mike King as a starter situation, I like that. Clark Schmidt has continued to pitch well. Like, there's a lot of stuff that we can draw on from these last couple of weeks and in these last couple of weeks of the season to have us feeling good about next year. I think I'm with you, though. I want Glaber and Cole to finish the season strong. I want them to get whatever contributions they can from the kids. I want more people to hit the ball over the fence. And I'm probably somewhere in that five range until offseason moves start being made. Whipple, that's going to wrap this up. Any parting shots from you?
Yeah, we didn't mention it, but I briefly have to shout out the Twitter argument I had with a lot of people about the quality of Fenway Park and the desirability of Boston, Massachusetts as a place for the biggest superstar in the professional baseball world to play. And listen, I was told a lot that I'd never been to Fenway, that I'd never lived in Boston. And, you know, these podcasts serve as record. That is simply not true. And in some of the worst ways, it's not true. But I think interesting career arc for me from going, having the Fenway curse to being accused of never going to Fenway. But at the same time, you know what? Like, I've been in Boston and I am one of the few people who survived and made it out alive. And I'm going to say that a small, you know, we're both closer to Boston than I think a lot of people realize from where we grew up. But there's a lot more to life than New England. And I think there's a lot more in the country, in the world, in the eyes of Shohei Ohtani. I'll believe it when I see it. And maybe, you know, the money always talks. The team has different things to recommend it. But I'll be damned if I sit here and, you know, accept the argument that Shohei Ohtani is going to target Boston, Massachusetts as the place he wants to spend the next decade. And I'll go on the record and say there is no way this happens. And feel free to clip this if it actually does happen, because I am that confident. There is no way. I mean, it's Boston. Come on.
Yeah, that people would be taken aback that you'd say no one prefers Boston to Southern California was ridiculous. Right.
And it, like, wasn't even a New York thing. I was just like, no, it's just Boston. Like, yeah. And I'm sorry that it's so obvious that all Boston residents are that insecure about their city. But it could not be more obvious every time they talked, they tweeted. And that's, you know what? We'll see. Let's check back when that happens. And I'm going to believe that Ohtani's comments about liking Fenway Park. the last thing I'll say is just everybody was like, Fenway is such a great place. Everyone says so.
No, it's not.
And then every player who commented just commented about how great the crowd was. Ignoring the fact that it's 15,000 less than Yankee Stadium in most ballparks. And they shove everyone in
there. All the seats are facing the wrong way.
Yeah,
half of them are behind pillars. the stadium wasn't really built when they say it was built, just like an exterior wall was actually built at that time. The rest of it burned down. Then the stadium was actually built mostly in like the 30s. Like Fenway is built on seats that don't face the stadium and lies.
Mm-hmm. And some other things that we won't mention on the pod, but it's not a great place.
Yes.
Shohei Ohtani will not go there.
Yeah. And the thing that you said to me that you're exactly right about is it shows that Boston is a cult. Like people cannot handle anything negative being said about Boston because it challenges the idea that Boston might not be the greatest place in the world. Like Boston operates more like North Korea than people want to admit.
It's a good note to leave it on. No comment, because again, as I said on the last pod, I might get in trouble, but I think the person I get in trouble with knows that I feel like this. So
yeah,
we're largely okay with that.
I think that's the case. All right. So that wraps things up for us here on this latest Yankees Files podcast. Whipple, I enjoyed it as always. People can keep up with everything we do at yankeesfiles.com. They can also keep up with us on Twitter. We're at Yankees Files, or even on TikTok. We're at Yankees Files Podcast. Podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe. If you like it, we hope you'll just subscribe, download it, listen to the episodes on silent a bunch of times or whatever it is. If you don't, we will see you guys again, similar time, similar place next week after the Yankees play the Blue Jays and then whoever it is they play after the Blue Jays. And
Diamondbacks.
Yeah, the Diamondbacks. Until then, let's go Yankees.